And maybe tomorrow will be hot but not so humid as the rest of the week is reportedly going to be. They're starting to name the heat waves. Anybody got any suggestions for this one? Climate chaos number one. All right, my name's Paul Muth. This is not Window on the World. That's tomorrow at 5, and maybe I'll have something from the Workers' Summit. Very little reporting. I've been tweeting various news organizations saying, well, if you're going to cover the Summit of the Americas in L.A., maybe you should cover the Workers' Summit, too, a little bit. Tried to get some audio from it. It was a Zoom event, mostly, and they had a thing where you could pick your language, and I guess I just stuck with the Facebook Live, and I got mostly Spanish, so I'll be looking around for simultaneous translations, if you will, on the recordings, because it should be on the list of things to look at, the opposition to the show in L.A., where many didn't show. Heard Blinken today. Oh, man. Never mind. One of the things that came out of it the U.S. is going to do is institute a medical corps, sending doctors to Latin America. Who'd have thunk it? Well, like, you know, the Cubans have been doing it. They were nominated for a Nobel Prize for going to Italy at the height of the pandemic a couple of years ago. Very grateful Italians for the help at a time of need. I'll just turn this all the way up. I've been scolded sometimes for being too soft-spoken, so maybe I'll just holler instead. I've got a full show, so I'm going to get it kicked off here. Radio Free Labor coming up in an hour. The rundown is Mumia greets the Workers' Summit, so I'll have something today on that. Gun control from Amy Goodman, breaking the sound barrier. The day before the hearing that talked about the 7 points plan of Trump, they didn't delineate it. It's like you should forward announce what the points are. That was one of my criticisms. Obviously, Cheney from Wyoming wants to run for president, people say. And it was very articulate, moving some ways, but gosh, she still gives me a horrible feeling in the pit of my stomach. I'm waiting for Raskin from wherever he is, Maryland, I don't know. And he'll talk about the Amendment 20 gambit. Just get the impasse going and then go to the House of Representatives and you vote by state, one state, one vote. Trump would have won that. Greg Palast, who talks about it, said that he wrote that up for Salon or Slate or something, and they said it was too conspiratorial. Okay. So the day before the hearings, Arun Gupta of the Independent Occupy movement going back all that time was with Dennis Bernstein. He's a regular correspondent with Sonali Kalatkar, who we'll have in the last segment, and hopefully I'll get it all on. It's a scholar from Georgia. I thought he would be from L.A., since that's where the movie industry is, and that's where Sonali Kalatkar does her programming from. It's now a weekly program, and it's got good stuff all the time. There's a piece on long COVID that I haven't listened to. I was going to play it until I realized that this is a better item. So anyway, here's Mumia working on his legal appeal, working on another book, no doubt about it, but sending a greeting out to comrades here. This device ought to have a rundown, but it doesn't.
My brothers, sisters, and comrades in Tijuana, I welcome you. Delegates of the excluded, people from Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, and beyond. Many of you come from poor nations, countries with relatively low GDPs, like Cuba, for example, which has a GDP roughly equal to Ghana. As I write to you, from the richest nation on earth. I have to add that I also write from a nation that cannot protect its own children. See the ugly massacre in Texas, where 19 babies were slain in elementary school while cops prowled the halls. Here, tens of thousands of former students can't afford to pay their loans to schools and colleges. Again, look at Cuba, where people can go from kindergarten to medical school for free. And not just Cubans, for students can go to medical school in Cuba, even if they aren't from Cuba. And remember, Cuba isn't a rich country. It does what it does because it dedicates its resources to public service medicine. What does it matter if America, with all its riches, couldn't prevent the deaths of 1 million people, 1 million people, because of COVID-19? In fact, you can go to any ghetto in America and see hunger and poverty, people who live in food deserts, people who are homeless, in fact. You'll also find the greatest level of imprisonment in the world. So why should poor nations listen to rich nations? What do they have to teach us? Racism, class strife, violent cops, corrupt politicians, greedy businessmen, militarism? The poor and excluded of the world have only each other. If we work in solidarity, we surely can do better. Thank you. Muchas gracias. With love and fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Series are recorded by Prison Radio.
Well said, indeed, my opinion. If I didn't say it, opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. I wish I could share a graphic on the radio. There's a graphic I used in Facebook on a post that got some attention, and then I have an article coming up. And the public eye, again, amazingly enough, not only on the transaction tax, but I had to make an aside at the beginning to talk about a study from the EPI, Economic Policy Institute, labor organization, labor-funded kind of think tank, that shows that, or asserts that, 58% of the inflation is due to corporate profits, which shouldn't be a surprise, 15%, which is what it is. Anyway, here's Amy's piece. There is a rally. There are rallies around the country. I don't know if there's one in town, maybe I'll see if I can Google that. March for Our Lives, Parkland students, original organizers of SAME.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Gun worship is transcendent in the United States. With 400 million guns in circulation, more guns than people, and only cursory controls on who can buy or access them, firearms are fetishized, celebrated, brandished throughout our society, delivering a devastating daily death toll unknown anywhere else in the world. This idolatry reveres above all else the semi-automatic AR-15, dubbed America's rifle by the NRA. In the wake of back-to-back massacres in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas, both committed by 18-year-old men with legally purchased AR-15-style semi-automatic rifles, victims and their advocates are pushing for genuine gun control. But the Congress, with so many of its members enthralled to and funded by the gun lobby, will only posture, pray, hold a moment or two of silence, then do virtually nothing.
Our two youngest children, Julian, 8, and Lexi, 10, who were at Robb Elementary.
That's Kimberly Matarubio in testimony before the House Committee on Oversight and Reform Wednesday, speaking remotely from Uvalde.
On the morning of May 24th, 2022, I dropped Lexi and Julian off at school a little after 7 a.m. My husband and I returned to the campus at 8 a.m. for Julian's award ceremony, and again at 10:30 a.m. for Lexi's award ceremony. Lexi received the Good Citizen Award and was also recognized for receiving all A's. At the conclusion of the ceremony, we took photos with her before asking her to pose for a picture with her teacher, Mr. Reyes. That photo, her last photo ever, was taken at approximately 10:54 a.m.
The teenage shooter arrived at the school about half an hour later, and while 19 police officers reportedly hovered outside a classroom door for close to an hour, he methodically killed 19 children and two of their teachers.
Today, we stand for Lexi, and as her voice, we demand action.
Kimberly Mata Rubio, who works as a reporter for the Uvalde Leader News, continued,
"We seek a ban on assault rifles and high-capacity magazines. We understand that for some reason, to some people, to people with money, to people who fund political campaigns, that guns are more important than children. So at this moment, we ask for progress. We seek to raise the age to purchase these weapons from 18 to 21 years of age. We seek red flag laws, stronger background checks. We also want to repeal gun manufacturers' liability immunity."
Zanetta Everhart of Buffalo also spoke at the congressional hearing. Her 21-year-old son, Zaire Goodman, worked at the top supermarket. He was wounded there May 14th when a white supremacist shooter killed 10 people, all of them African-American.
"To the lawmakers who feel that we do not need stricter gun laws, let me paint a picture for you. My son, Zaire, has a hole in the right side of his neck, two on his back, and another on his left leg, caused by an exploding bullet from an AR-15. As I clean his wounds, I can feel pieces of that bullet in his back. Shrapnel will be left inside of his body for the rest of his life. Now I want you to picture that exact scenario for one of your children."
On the same day as the hearing, the U.S. House passed, along mostly partisan lines, the Protecting Our Kids Act, which includes limited gun control provisions, such as raising the minimum age for purchasing semi-automatic weapons from 18 to 21, and banning ammunition clips that hold more than 10 rounds, excluding those already privately owned. This bill is presumed dead on arrival in the Senate, where it lacks any chance of reaching the 60 votes needed to overcome the guaranteed Republican filibuster. AR-15s have enthusiastic defenders among Senate Republicans, like Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, who spoke to Vice News.
"Killing feral pigs in the, you know, whatever, the middle of Louisiana."
And then there's South Dakota Senator John Thune.
"In my state, they use them to shoot prairie dogs and, you know, other types of varmints."
While Republican senators protect the rights of a few to slaughter pigs and other varmints with military-grade assault weapons, Uvalde's only pediatrician, Dr. Roy Guerrero, described to the House Oversight Committee what he saw in the hospital as he responded to the mass shooting.
"Two children whose bodies have been pulverized by bullets fired at them, decapitated, whose flesh had been ripped apart, that the only clue at their identities was a blood-splattered cartoon clothes still clinging to them."
The doctor ended by calling on elected officials to take action on gun control.
"You are the doctors, and our country is the patient. We are lying on the operating table, riddled with bullets like the children of Robb Elementary and so many other schools. We are bleeding out, and you are not there.
We need a comprehensive assault weapons ban now." I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Indictments of the significance of the indictments of the...
Regular listeners recognize Dennis Bernstein. We'll get to him straight away. As I mentioned, this was recorded Wednesday, so it doesn't incorporate anything. I was looking for Greg Palast on the issue, and I'm sure there'll be an election theft report incorporating the report on the coup. As I mentioned, I have my critiques, but U.S. fascism needs to be confronted. Makes for a complicated... All right, well, let's see how complicated Arun Gupta gets talking about the indictment that came down the day before.
Indictments of the significance of the indictments of the Proud Boys, along now with the Oath Keepers, as key players in the attempted insurrection and overthrow of the 2020 U.S. election. Arun Gupta, welcome back. You did a wonderful story. We talked in a wonderful story. We talked in January about your series in Raw Story about the Oath Keepers, and it looks like they've been coupled up There's some serious indictments. Before we get into that and the real implications, could you just remind people where these folks are coming from? Say a little bit about who the Oath Keepers are and who the Proud Boys are so we can get a sense of their history, their background, their context.
Yeah, hi, Dennis. So the Oath Keepers start in 2009 by Stuart Rhodes. And what he's doing is he's referencing this oath that U.S. military officers are supposed to take to defend the U.S. Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. But he gives it a twist where the Oath Keepers, what they pledge to, is also oaths that they will not obey. And essentially, he has this fever fantasy of a war that is going to be waged against U.S. Citizens. And really, what this is about, it's essentially a racist fantasy, right? Because what happens in 2009? You have Barack Obama elected as U.S. president, the first black president. And meanwhile, for 8 years, the extreme right had been pretty quiet. There had been a huge decline in militias and extremist groups during the Bush years, even as they were giving themselves these extraordinary powers as a result of the war on terror, the U.S. Patriot Act, the NSA spying. You had these massive roundup of Muslim Americans and deportations. And Stuart Rhodes, who was a lawyer, he was a disbarred. He basically, he's a smart guy in some ways. He went to Yale Law School and he wrote a paper where he absolutely shredded kind of the basis for the U.S. war on terror and its legal justification to imprison U.S. citizens, which the Bush administration was doing and then which the Obama administration continued. But, like I said, this was a war that was being carried out against Muslim Americans. And the moment Obama comes in, Stuart Rhodes starts to fantasize that white Americans are the gun owners, conservatives are the ones who are going to be rounded up. And this completely segues, joins forces with the Tea Party movement, which is this kind of racist backlash to Barack Obama, right? Because it's all about the founding fathers and their words, take back America, you know, and as well, take back America from whom? From the black guy. And so it has very much this racist impulse. Now, if we go further back, and what I explained in the series I did for the Raw Stories, is you can draw a direct line between the reemergence of violent far-right extremism in the 1970s and 80s, right? You had the Klan that operated for a century, and that was kind of laid low eventually by the civil rights movement and by finally belated federal and state investigations into a century of racial terror, racist terror. You have a reemergence in groups like Posse Comitatus and the Aryan Nations. They were kind of the next generation of the Klan and the neo-Nazis. And they then they fantasize about a coup against the U.S. government. And so what I explain is you can see very much a direct line from the things they were saying to what the Oath Keepers then start to say. What the Oath Keepers and Stuart Rhodes, he was very much the, not just the founder, but the guiding figure. He kept all control to himself pretty much. What he did very successfully was to sanitize this type of extremist, violent, white nationalist history. For one, they made a big show of, oh, we're banning racists, even though they were often consorting with white nationalists on the fringes. And right. At the same time, he would disavow violence, even though he kept saying there's going to be a revolution. And so this, for a lot of years, kind of laid dormant. And after Obama was elected, there's this huge surge in right-wing hate groups, militias, extremist groups. It goes from about 35 in its low point in the 2000s to over 1,000 extremist groups by 2013, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. But they were derided as cosplay boomers, as keyboard warriors, the Oath Keepers, because they really weren't taking any action. This all starts to change with the election of Donald Trump. And the same year as the 2016 campaign, you have Gavin McInnes, this right-wing extremist, one of the founders of Vice News. He found the Proud Boys. And he, you know, it's kind of like double game that the extremist right has played, that, oh, this is, you know, it's not real, it's just a joke. You know, he's just like, oh, this is just a drinking club. But at the same time, he would say, you know, we're a gang, we're going to kill you. He gave an infamous interview where he said that. And so the Proud Boys start to become one of the groups that are the shock troops for Trumpism. You know, they describe themselves as we're Western chauvinists. You know, we're a drinking fraternity. But really, again, what they're doing is sanitizing white nationalism. Then over the Trump years, these two forces start to unite. And there are also many other extremist actors like, you know, like really violent groups like the Adam Waffen Division, violent neo-Nazis, the Rise Above Movement, Identity Europa. You know, and in 2017, everyone, a lot of people are shocked to see the emergence of this violent white nationalist extremism in Charlottesville. And the Proud Boys, meanwhile, basically turned Portland, Oregon into their proving ground. And the Oath Keepers would also, Oath Keepers members would start to come out to Portland, and they would fight anti-fascists. And there's this whole, and again, I do an explanation in the series where I explain how the quote-unquote liberal mayor of Portland, Oregon, essentially allowed the city to become a proving ground for the coup plotters. The January 6th coup probably would not have happened if Portland did not provide this kind of friendly staging ground for the violent white nationalists, basically to try out their methods, to engage in mob violence, to recruit other people, to network. They would come here, they would fight anti-fascists. The police would often outright assist them. This is very well documented. And then they would use videos of the violence to draw in new recruits. So this kind of is a slow motion creation of these shock troops for Trumpism. And it all comes to a head on January 6th. And what we have with the most recent indictment is the Department of Justice details how the leadership of the Proud Boys were intimately involved with trying to overthrow the U.S. government on January 6th. There was a previous indictment that said the president, Henry Enrique Carrillo, Joseph Biggs, Ethan Nordine, these are all key members. And I've actually interviewed all these guys as well when they came out to brawl in the Pacific Northwest.
Just a technical thing. So the Oath Keepers, they were initially indicted in January, and then I guess a more serious, thorough indictment was just unsealed this week. These are pretty dangerous characters who, it was clear, attempted to work with Trump to overthrow the government. Why did it take them an extra 4, 5, 6 months to get indicted?
You know, that's a hard question to answer. If you look at the actual indictment, which I've gone through, and it's on the DOJ website, they're obviously, they flipped a number of people. There's a couple of Oath Keepers who have pled guilty and are cooperating witnesses. There are also at least one Proud Boy, maybe more, who are also cooperating witnesses. And from them, they have gotten access to these encrypted chats. Carrillo and Biggs and Nordine from the Proud Boys and Stuart Rhodes from the Oath Keepers were using to coordinate this assault on the Capitol on January 6th. So it's a stage-by-stage, it's a step-by-step process. I think kind of related to that is a very important issue is, why wasn't this stopped years ago? You know, the Proud Boys were just going around the country, engaging, crossing state lines, to engage in this violent activity. And of course, Trump's Department of Justice was never going to issue an indictment against them. But that didn't mean that various state-level attorney generals couldn't bring indictments against the Proud Boys, or that there couldn't have been some sort of cooperation, where you see this all the time, right, where a group of attorney generals at the state level will get together and file a federal lawsuit. And they could have had something waiting in the wings on the assumption that a Democrat would get in power. But none of this happened. The thing is, and, it also gets back to January 6th, that there was an extraordinary number of warnings that everyone knew, Department of Homeland Security, FBI, the National Guard, the D.C. police, everyone knew this was coming, that there was going to be a violent coup attempt, and yet nothing was done to prevent it. And this is part of the problem with how white supremacy is embedded in, political institutions, but law enforcement as well. And there's basically this history of that law enforcement agencies will react with extreme prejudice against the left, even when it is being completely peaceful, nonviolent, engaging in protected First Amendment activity. It essentially waged a war against Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement in the 1960s. But excuse me,
bless you. And it's also you saw them come out of the corner swinging when it was about Occupy Wall Street. They took off the gloves. Not only were there violent beatings, but the surveillance, the investigations were extraordinary, right?
Oh, yeah, Occupy Wall Street, of course, that DHS was coordinating these calls. That was a little complicated because, if you look at the history of law enforcement agencies, the police at the local level are very jealous of their power and their territory. So it wasn't that the federal government, Obama's DHS, they weren't, telling them, go in and do this, but they were helping to lay the groundwork. But you see it even more so with the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yes.
Where James Comey... and they invent, the FBI, they invent this, absurd category called Black Identity Extremism, which is just an utter fabrication and this kind of false equivalent that, sure, you have these violent white nationalists who've committed hundreds of murders over the last 15 years. And we're trying to now say, like, you know, black people fighting for their basic political rights and human rights are the equivalent of neo-Nazis and white nationalists who are trying to commit mass murder. But in terms of what went on January 6th, in terms of this indictment, what the Department of Justice has done is it shows how the Proud Boys were really intimately involved in coordinating forces. That's what this indictment does. It uses their encrypted chats to show how they were marshaling troops. They were telling them, you know, this is where to be on January 6th. Here's how to disguise yourself. Here's the communications instruments, walkie-talkies and apps to use. And here's the plan that we're going to go in and basically try and we're going to coup the U.S. government and stop the transfer of power, the constitutional transfer of power to the new president, to the elected president, Joe Biden.
We're speaking with Arun Gupta. He's a wonderful reporter. We're talking, among other things, about a series he did for Raw Story back in January. He's been on this story and watching the situation unfold. Of course, tomorrow, the buildup is overwhelming. I've seen, this is more than some of the great Hollywood movies of our time. In fact, they've got a Hollywood producer or a television producer to do this. What are your expectations and how would you like to see this investigation go? It is interesting that when they put this indictment out, they made sure a key aspect of the new variation on the indictment has the Proud Boys meeting with the Oath Keepers. They're making a big deal out of that. Your thoughts on that and where this investigation, where you think this is going, where you'd like it to go?
Yeah, I mean, clearly, there is a lot of evidence that this was a coordinated attack, and also the three percenters. That's another violent militia. One of the interesting facets is that a lot of it is ex-military veterans. Three of the four main Proud Boys leadership: Joseph Biggs, Ethan Nordine, and I think Dominic Pozzola. They are military veterans. Stuart Rhodes is, of the Oath Keepers, is also a military veteran. So in some ways, this is, you know, what you see often in a lot of countries where the U.S. instigates coups, supports coups, that they come from within the military itself. And so this is what, in fact, you have seeing here, you know, and we have all those reports of January 6th, like Trump supporters attacking police and then whipping out their badges saying, like, we're police also, even as they're basically trying to kill D.C. police and Capitol Police. In terms of where this is going to go, you know, it's going to be hard for them, I think, to get a conviction, because what we have seen historically is that juries are reluctant to convict white nationalist extremists. You know, I covered the Bundy occupation, and these guys took over by force the U.S. Wildlife Refuge in Eastern Oregon in January of 2016, held it, had all sorts of weapons there. I was there visiting every day for a week, and they're, like, walking around with all these semi-automatic rifles, handguns, et cetera, and it's illegal to do that, and they were acquitted.
It is illegal.
I mean, it's completely illegal. And they were still acquitted, you know, by a jury, you know. And then we saw with the, you know, the Michigan coup plotters who were also acquitted of a.
And they were spitting in the police's faces during a pandemic.
So go ahead.
No, just the amazing amount of things they've been able to get away with. I want you to talk more about the investigation, and then I want you to talk about the fact that whatever happens here, we still got a very serious, dangerous Trump on our hands.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, you know, in the base case scenario, all these people, it's I was going to say guys, I think it is virtually all guys with a couple of exceptions, get convicted and thrown, you know, in jail for 20 years, and we never have to think about them again. But these are just the shock troops. And the reality is that the Republicans have been laying the groundwork to steal the next election in 2024, the next presidential election. And you frankly have a Democratic president who is completely just not up to the task. You know, as however much of a nice guy you want to think Joe Biden is, I mean, he is of both symbolically and actually just this decaying symbol of a failing, quasi-democratic institution. They have done nothing in terms of voting rights. And, you know, if we remember that when finally Biden last December made a push for voting rights legislation, he was snubbed by Stacey Abrams when he went to Georgia to make this high-profile push for, you know, this John Lewis Act that would actually protect federal elections from all these machinations that the Republicans are engaging at the state level, where they're laying the groundwork to overturn the popular vote. He was snubbed because he took a year to actually put some urgency into the fact that, hey, there's this grave danger to the election process, to enfranchisement. We haven't seen any sort of a federal election protection coming from the Biden administration. And I think everyone's just kind of holding their breath and have no idea what to do, that, you know, there could very well be a restoration in 2024. And then the gloves are completely off. You know, we know from Trump's first time in office that he basically never planned to leave office. And now if he gets back in, he's not going to make the same mistakes he did the first time, which is he's not going to abide by any constitutional prohibitions. I think if he gets back in office, that basically that's the end of the American democratic experiment. As flawed as it was, it's better than a dictatorship by someone like Trump.
I'm going to ask you to step back a little bit and give us a longer view. Now, I started seriously investigating these white supremacists in 1995 when there were reports of over 100 black churches that were burned throughout the South. They were burning all over the place.
Yes, yeah.
And I started that investigation. The day I landed in Mississippi, in Jackson, Mississippi, I'm looking at the headlines, and a couple of days before, a white supremacist by the name of Larry Shoemake had taken over a fast food joint downtown and opened fire on the black citizens of Jackson. And they ultimately killed him. When they went back to his house, he had notes for a race war. So my point is, and then this is in the context of all these churches burning, and you had the number, by the way, you had the number three guy in the COINTEL program, Jim Ingram, investigating the church burnings. So they had a lot of power then. They could have these old boy racist parties. We reported about that, where you'd literally have ATF, FBI, various federal agents participating in old style racist parties. And it was unbelievable. But it wasn't as powerful. It didn't have the planting now. It didn't have the roots. What is different now, and why should we be more afraid than we were then when the churches were burning?
Well, from the long view, the changes I think that are important to look at is one, the rise of right-wing hate radio. People, you know, especially as epitomized by Rush Limbaugh. And, you know, if we remember, like, what Trump really did was he took Rush Limbaugh's rhetoric and turned it into a plan for how to win the presidency. That's why he gave, you know, Rush Limbaugh the Presidential Medal of Freedom, because it was Limbaugh who really showed Trump how he could use this, like, just absolutely vile, racist, misogynist, rhetoric to build a powerful base among the right and take power. And this goes back to the Reagan administration and the ending of the Fairness Doctrine, the rise of Fox News, that this kind of like extreme partisanship and also this propensity to just fabricate the news, like just as this total like fever dream of race wars and wars on children, you know, that has now become a great replacement theory, right? You know, Tucker Carlson, the most powerful basically news commentator in the country, has turned his show into the white nationalist power hour, where he's spouted on about the great replacement theory over 400 times. And then added to that is social media, you know, where you have this ability to create these networks, these almost cults. You know, it's just like we know this tendency of people to kind of associate with those who they already agree with. And that's not so bad if you're based in reality. But social media has really proved to be a powerful tool across the world for inciting violence, inciting group hatred, for taking you know, hateful ideas and translating them into real world violence. You know, we see this in India, we see this in Europe, you know, places like Myanmar, a lot of other countries where they use social media to essentially incite and then carry out violent pogroms against targeted groups. And so I think, you know, this is kind of the a lot of the groundwork. But the other thing we can't ignore, of course, is the war on terror. And what you have is this 20-year-long war that is basically creating all these enemies, right? You know, immigrants are the enemy, Muslims are the enemies, and then you're creating all these veterans who have fought in these wars, have often committed violence, extremely violent acts, coming back with PTSD. And this is not to say that, you know, this is all veterans who have PTSD or been in this war, but we can't ignore the fact that the Oath Keepers, that they their base was active and or retired military veterans and police officers. That's specifically who they their membership that they were looking to recruit. And so this has created the conditions for essentially a lot of the angry people, and then combined with the media, where they are able to get all this money and power, the right-wing echo chamber, by constantly keeping people in this state of hate and anxiety, it created the perfect conditions for someone like Trump to come along and take advantage of it and to build this kind of like powerful authoritarian cult of personality movement.
It is, and of course it caught many of us off guard, because nobody really thought, I never anticipated that, I really never realized that Trump was a tried and true white supremacist who really was a caliber. I thought he was just a corrupt businessman, but he's managed to do something a lot more than be a corrupt businessman. He's a lot smarter, sharper, and capable of doing things than anybody ever thought. I think that's part of the problem. It's a surprise, surprise. I'm not as dumb as you will all liberals think I am.
Yeah, and you know, it's one thing I like to say. I mean, you know, liberals love to make fun of Trump. Like, look, the guy has no book learning, he has no erudition, but he's the one in power. He's the one who's calling the shots. Yes. And he, and even though he's not in power anymore, he's laying the groundwork. You know, unless you know an aneurysm or all those Coca-Colas and Big Macs intervene, he's going to be the nominee in 2024. And even if he doesn't win, it doesn't matter, because the Republicans at the state level are laying the groundwork to dispute whatever the outcome of the election is, and appoint their own group of electors. And then if it gets thrown to the House, I mean, there's going to be a landslide this November. You know, it's just like the Biden administration is, I think, just an utter disaster. Right. You know, and that's what, you know, we'll look back on in a few years and say there was this brief window where if they had been bold, right, you know, even if Bernie Sanders had somehow become president, I think it would have still been hard for him to get to do what needed to be done, but he would have at least been committed to it. You know, it's just like, first of all, to protect the integrity of the vote, to protect the integrity of the federal election, but also to give people again a stake in the system, in society, by saying like, hey, we're actually going to show that government can work for you by eliminating student debt, by making making healthcare a fundamental right that every single person add, by addressing things like the housing crisis, the low wage, you know, the scourge of low wage work in this country. He was absolutely committed to trying to make the government, at least on some level, work for the people instead of work for the ruling class. And yet when someone would like Biden, he is so inept. We're looking to him hoping that he can somehow stop the rise of American fascism and stop catastrophic climate change, but he still hasn't been able to remove Louis DeJoy as postmaster general, who's destroying the U.S. postal
We're just about out of
time. Yeah, they're out of time. That's Arun Gupta. Raw Story, I believe, was where he did the series. He embedded in a variety of militant right groups on the West Coast, and probably some in Michigan too, I think. Good stuff. I think Antifa was supposed to show up. They had been fighting with the Proud Boys. There's some people on the right say, well, they were armed because they'd had prior history of fighting with Antifa, as if that was not part of a plan to stop the certification and throw it into the House of Representatives. I misspoke. It's the 12th Amendment that allows the states to vote, one state, one vote, if there's an impasse. And that was really, I think, maybe that's step seven of the plan, the seven-part plan that's talked about. I'm going to turn to a broader issue of militarism and spooks. I haven't heard this, actually, but some sections I heard were quite good. And there's a movie associated with it. I won't get it all on, I don't think, but I'll be looking up the movie, which documents the way media, Hollywood movies, Top Gun, Maverick, are facilitated by the Defense Department, and the CIA even gets involved in cultural production, if you will. So 20 minutes, 19, Radio Free Labor coming up. And again, this guy is from Georgia. Well introduced here by Sonali Kolhatkar, running out the hour here before Radio Free Labor, which runs for a couple of hours till 1 o'clock. I'm sure it'll be insightfully packed. And they do a lot of cultural analysis, too, with the Outer Limits and horror films. It's an insight into the world that I don't know that much about, actually, the horror films part anyway.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The new film, Top Gun Maverick, is breaking box office records and has already become the highest grossing film of actor Tom Cruise's career, raking in $86 million over last weekend alone. Top Gun Maverick, which is a sequel to the 1986 classic, has received highest ratings from critics and audiences. But the new film was made in close conjunction with the U.S. military. This is hardly surprising, given that the film is set within the military and requires generous use of massive military hardware that only the Pentagon could provide. My guest, Roger Stahl, wrote a recent op-ed in the LA Times saying, quote, "Americans should have a right to know the extent of the military's influence on the shows and films they consume." Stahl is the director of a new documentary available via the Media Education Foundation. It's called Theaters of War, How the Pentagon and CIA Took Hollywood. He's also a professor of communication studies at the University of Georgia. Welcome to the program, Roger.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about the film Top Gun itself before we get into the broader issue of how the Pentagon affects films in Hollywood. It is a very glamorous pro-military film, right? Just watching the trailer, it's hard not to get excited about the way in which people who are in the military interact with one another and, of course, the very big toys that they get to play with. And that's the point, right?
Sure. It's glamorous. It's also a little bit silly. It's nostalgic. I laughed and cried. I enjoyed it very much. So it's a great Hollywood film. It's extremely seductive. Of course, the military is very interested in working with producers like Jerry Bruckheimer on films like this for a number of reasons. One of them is recruiting. The Navy and the Air Force have missed the recruitment quotas as of late. And, this is a way for them to, you know, use a very seductive medium in order to bring those numbers up.
So you watched the film. I have to confess that I did not watch it. So when watching the film, what is the feeling that you get from the imagery of these massive machines of war, you know, the fighter jets, and what they're capable of, the sheer power that they're capable of?
Well, that's one of the things that they're after in films like Top Gun Maverick or any other military support adventure. They're interested in glamorizing the weapons. In this case, it's the F/A-18. Which is the Navy's signature weapon, the machine that glides gracefully off the aircraft carrier. And of course, they're interested in sort of giving a bigger picture of the Navy and its capabilities. I spoke to an ex-military person about this film, and they said, you know, in addition to all the other things that you're probably interested in and want to mention on interviews like this and others, Roger, you should really, you know, also think about the way that the Navy is positioning, you know, the fighter pilot as an alternative to, say, cruise missiles. So, you know, there's kind of these sort of interagency competitions that are going on here. And if you saw the film, you know, the kind of mission that these fighter pilots are on is one that could easily be accomplished through a series of, you know, cruise missile strikes, but they use these fighter pilots instead. And, you know, so it's not only an argument for the continued funding of these weapon systems and forging emotional connections between the average citizen and these weapon systems so that we don't object the next time the Pentagon defense appropriations budget goes up in front of Congress. The Navy is, you know, trying to position, you know, the platform itself, the fighter pilots, the F-18s, and the naval aircraft carriers as being superior to other forms of, you know, strike capabilities.
So how easy is it for a filmmaker in Hollywood to work with the military? If they want a scene or two with a piece of, you know, huge military hardware that is very difficult or expensive to replicate in a studio, what do they have to do? And what do they have to give the military in return?
Well, this is kind of the meat of the matter. This is what I call the deal that gets struck between producers who want to invoke the military in some way or feel it's necessary for the film and the interests of the military itself. They come together, they meet, and you know, both interests are satisfied by the deal that is struck. So if you're a producer who wants to do this kind of thing, you bring your script to one of the branch offices of the Navy, Air Force, or Army in LA. And there's a main office at the Pentagon, but there are three branch offices in LA. The Marines have their office in Camp Pendleton. And you kind of plop the script down on the desk and you say, can I have access to some of these military goods? And they might include access to personnel as extras or access to bases and equipment like F-18 fighter jets, something like that. And they take a look at the script and go over it with a fine-tooth comb, and not just the parts that invoke the military, but the whole thing, the whole story. And they usually return with three or four pages of script change suggestions. Sometimes they will object to the script, the sort of entire storyline, and reject the script outright. But most of the time they come back with suggestions, and you as the producer or director decide to integrate these or make an argument that you don't want to. If the military is satisfied with the changes that you make, then they're gonna go ahead with the project and give you the goods. You will sign a contract with them and then get started filming. But if not, if you don't make those changes, then you're out of luck and you have to kind of scramble for other ways of representing the military hardware or change the script entirely. And sometimes, you know, we found over the course of our survey of the available documents, we find that there are a lot of projects that just die if they don't get military help. Hmm.
So tell me what you and your fellow researchers found about the extent of the partnership between Hollywood and the military. I suppose you and others thought that it was smaller than it actually was.
I think everybody thought it was smaller. I mean, I've been working on this issue for about 15 years now, the contours of what we call the military entertainment complex. And I just thought it was a small office at the Pentagon. They just did it maybe a couple hundred films. And everybody that studies this, you know, it's a small group of maybe a couple dozen people who have done this over the years, assume the same thing. So that was a scholarly consensus. And what we found in just the last 5 years, because a even smaller group, a subset of that research group, has been doing hundreds, maybe even thousands of Freedom of Information Act requests over the past 5 years. We've had additional archives open up as well that have made available about 30,000 pages of documents that, you know, me and four other people have on hand that we're closely attending to. We didn't have those before. And they suggest, we can confirm, in fact, that it's not just a couple hundred films in the course of the 20th and 21st centuries, but now we can confirm that the military and CIA have been involved with, and this means they've had a contractual relationship with, a supportive relationship with over 2,000 films, or around 2,500. And that number keeps growing as we discover more documents.
Wow.
And this number is, you know, on the conservative side, because many of those are TV shows that are multi-episodic. And if you count all the episodes, then the number is more like 10 or 11,000. So it's roughly, you know, 10 times the number of projects that we previously assumed. It's a huge part of our entertainment diet.
When you see films like Top Gun Maverick, and it's clear that the military had to have been involved to give them access to this hardware, do we know the extent to which the military has impacted the script of the film?
In the case of Top Gun Maverick, you know, we've put in many, many requests, and we've only gotten a few documents. The military has been very cagey and very evasive about this, and because they, you know, the film hadn't come out yet, and they, in a lot of instances, want to kind of resist Freedom of Information Act requests on the grounds that they will reveal trade secrets and hurt the relationship between the military and filmmakers, and also compromise the business interests of those filmmakers. So we got just a few heavily redacted documents from the military regarding Top Gun Maverick, and you know, that's definitely part of the problem, is that, you know, we've been doing this for a long time, and the Pentagon has gotten kind of wise to the fact that there's a couple of researchers on the trail, and they have increasingly rejected or redacted the kinds of requests that we've made in the last year or so. So we've got a lot of documents at first, but now we're getting, you know, say a tranche of 1,000 documents that are 100% redacted, which is a kind of funny thing to receive in the mail. So they're getting wise to us, and we don't expect that we're going to get a lot more Freedom of Information Act responses that are going to yield useful documentation in the future. And this is why, you know, I think it's necessary for the people, you and I, just regular citizens, to understand the scope of this, or at least try to understand what we know from the documents that we have, and perhaps do something about it, enact some legislation that will force the hand of the public relations offices at the Pentagon shows that they are involved in. And you know, if I had my wish list in front of me, it would include releasing the documents that that contain references to script changes that were actually made. Now, your original question is like, how much do we know about actual script changes? We know details of actual script changes for, I would say, about 200 or 300 films at this point, based on the documentation that we have. And, you know, when I referred earlier to 3 to 4 pages of script changes that are usually passed on to the request for script changes passed on to the producers as these negotiations are happening, we have those documents. And so we have a really good sense at this point exactly the kinds of things that they are likely to ask and the kinds of things that they're likely to object to. In the documents, they call them showstoppers. The things that if you don't change this, then we are not going to support
like deal breakers, basically.
That's right.
Well, let's turn to your documentary, Theaters of War, How the Pentagon and CIA Took Hollywood. And here's actually the trailer of the film.
So say you're a producer and you want to make a war film.
You would walk into the entertainment liaison office in downtown Los Angeles.
You say, I want to film at an Air Force base, or I want an aircraft carrier, or I want some Black Hawk helicopters, or whatever it is.
And they would tell you straight away, give us your entire script.
And we've worked with Mr. Bay here since Armageddon, if I'm not mistaken, and hope to do more of the same. I've got a direct line to the Pentagon.
Some people probably would say, well, yeah, I've heard of this, like, you know, Top Gun, maybe Black Hawk Down, maybe some of the Marvel series.
But what they don't know is how systematic this has been and how huge this operation has been.
You can call it censorship, you can call it propaganda. It's all of these things.
Now these freedom of information requests that have been successful allow us to actually look at that list, and it's stunning.
What we've found is that thousands upon thousands upon thousands of products have been affected and are often rewritten at script level by the national security state in the United States. Do normal people know about that? No, of course they don't.
And that is the trailer of a new documentary called Theaters of War, How the Pentagon and CIA Took Hollywood, made by my guest Roger Stahl, a professor of communication studies at the University of Georgia. Roger, tell me about this documentary. You're obviously, it was made before Top Gun Maverick came out. There's a long history of the relationship between the U.S. military and Hollywood. What does this film dig into?
It tries to give an understanding of exactly what we know about this relationship between Hollywood and the military, and provide a history of it, provide a sense of the kinds of script changes historically that the Pentagon has asked for, and how this, you know, verges on, even though it might not fit the actual definition of censorship or propaganda understood in the classical sense, verges on something like that. So, you know, it describes the nature of the deal. It describes how we've come to know in the past 5 years, you know, the detective mystery story of how we acquired the documents. And, you know, interviews a number of academics who have studied this kind of thing, journalists, Hollywood insiders, producers, and also a number of people who have worked previously in the Pentagon. And mainly goes through the documents that we have acquired in detail, film by film, television show by television.
And can you give us, can you throw out some names of some well-known films that people might recognize that you found the Pentagon had a hand in?
Well, they're the obvious ones. You know, your Top Gun, Iron Man, Transformers. These films, have military hardware in the backgrounds, and everyone will be able to recognize them and name them as, you know, having something to do with the Pentagon. But you know, there are others that, you know, wouldn't normally come to mind necessarily. I mean, my favorite one in the film is Godzilla in 2014, because it's, you know, this is a franchise that's about nuclear bombs. And, you know, since 1954, Godzilla has been an allegory for the nuclear strike on Japan and a critique of it. And, you know, all the way through 1998, Godzilla was a critique of nuclear proliferation and the bomb. But by the time you get to 2014, the military is fully involved in this film. And, you know, They've got military hardware everywhere. They, you know, in the documents they proclaim.
I mean, it's so ironic, right? For a film that should have been about the warnings of militarism to basically partner with a military.
Well, it even goes beyond, you know, just being ironic that they're partnering with the military. You know, the story completely flips. Mm. Before it's a critique of the bomb, and now in 2014, the bomb becomes a kind of co-hero in the film alongside the military and alongside Godzilla. So they use the bomb itself to sort of blow up the bad, what are they called? You know, the bad monsters, and so it supercharges Godzilla. Nuclear power supercharges Godzilla to, as I say in the film, fight the good fight, and they use the bomb against the evil monsters. So, you know, the bomb goes from, you know, being a threat to being one of the heroes, and you know, the critique ultimately disappears. And my favorite little change, you know, we talk about 3 to 4 pages of script changes that are made in these films. You know, the military objects at one point to a speech that a Japanese character makes in the film about his grandfather surviving the bombing of Hiroshima. And they say, this is going to be a showstopper for us if you don't take it out. If this is an apology or critique of the military, the nuclear arsenal, then we're just not going to have it in the film. And they end up taking it out and they replace it with this rather banal, generic speech about, you know, about how we shouldn't mess with nature. And if we do, then this kind of thing, you know, the plot of the film is the result. So that, you know, they take out references, you know, critical references to the nuclear bomb and the nuclear arsenal, and, you know, essentially flip the plot into, you know, a celebration of the nuclear bomb instead.
I mean, it's just really remarkable. And for you to say that the bomb basically became the second hero, it made me think about how these, you know, the fighter jets and all of these big pieces of military hardware that taxpayers pay for become co-stars in the film, right? Essentially, they are romanticized, they become enablers of freedom in the fantasy, Hollywood fantasy that the military is engaged in. Now, if the Pentagon makes these red lines saying that this is a deal breaker, of course, Hollywood filmmakers could walk away, but they don't. Hollywood filmmakers don't need to make pro-military films, but they choose to. The military is only a happy participant. Does all of this lead you to conclude that Hollywood is a willing participant in military PR? No one's forcing Hollywood. We don't live in an authoritarian state where the military forces our movie industry to make pro-military films. This is something that Hollywood thinks it can make money doing, and so it does it, but it, of course, does it slyly and secretly. And so it's a willing PR participant for the military, it seems.
Yeah, we have to understand Hollywood, first and foremost, is not really a cultural institution, but an economic one that has cultural influence. And so when they're making the calculations, these financial calculations about how much they're going to put into a film and how much they expect to get out of it, you know, when you're looking at cooperation with the military is, you know, potentially saving you $3 to $4 million, as, you know, Jerry Bruckheimer estimated that cooperation in the military saved a film like Black Hawk Down. And, you know, he said also, we probably wouldn't have been able to make the film without it. Then, you know, you're talking about a significant financial advantage to filmmakers that are going to make these deals with the military. And in fact, the industry understands this. In 1998, there's all these talks of, you know, a peace dividend and budget cuts to the military. And one of the things that was kind of on the chopping block at that point was the Entertainment Media Office that does these deals with Hollywood. And Jack Valenti, who was president of the Motion Picture Association of America at the time, this is the trade organization for for Hollywood, went to Congress and did a bunch of lobbying and made sure that the office stayed online, and it did. It survived. So you know, you have this kind of, as long as it remains quasi secret, as long as there's not a lot of public objection to this relationship, it remains a huge economic subsidy to Hollywood, a huge economic advantage to producers and directors. They don't want to get rid of it. The only thing that's really threatening about it is when people find out and object to the fact that this, you know, scripts are compromised, and this is, you know, turning into a quasi-propaganda operation.
So fine.
Not so quasi, maybe. That was Roger Stahl from some institution in Georgia. The interviewer is Sonali Kalantkar out of L.A. I thought she would have an L.A. guest talking about how the Pentagon fuels the military and entertainment complex. Started out with Top Gun Maverick. There is the film that was mentioned at the top. I'll mention it at the end. Theaters of War, How the Pentagon and the CIA Took Hollywood, Roger Stahl. It's apparently a free viewing. Apparently he has other video up that are costing on Vimeo. I guess he's a filmmaker as well as a scholar. And I think I'm timing out here because it's time for Radio Free Labor with a full triad, a full compliment. Welcome back. And I'll get my tail out of here after playing an underwriting announcement from a local business. And enjoy the weather, because the heat is on. It's coming.
Elliott Counseling Group has been providing compassionate mental health care to the community for nearly 20 years. Elliott Counseling Group offers counseling and behavioral health medication support and management to children, adolescents, and adults of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Champaign, Urbana, Tuscola, Tarleton, Mattoon, and surrounding communities, with visits currently held both in person and via online telehealth appointments. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com or by phone at 217-398-9066.